Session number 11357.
Harry Clark, Reel 5.
Yes, we finally slid to a halt. The landing field was covered in a smoke screen. It wasn't so dense on the ground as it was from above that we'd plunged into. We rapidly got out of the glider, pulled the handcart out with all the extra gear and ammunition in, and just as we got out, a German tank tore by, followed by a German motorcyclists. We don't know who was the most scared, him or us. And we immediately took up a position of defence around the glider and watched the appalling carnage that ensued. There were gliders crashing into trees, buildings, plunging into the earth. It was a sight. It was mass murder. It's a sight I'll never forget as long as I live. And I took a vow there and then, along with the others, that never again would we travel by glider. We didn't know how bad it was till later in the day. We finally made a run for a timber yard some 100 yards to our front and got under cover behind the timber while we gathered our wits about us. While in this timber yard, I heard a voice saying, "Lightning, lightning." I didn't know what it was. I said, well, and I went round the corner and there was a chap crouched behind the timber. And he looked at me and said lightning, which didn't mean anything to me. But what it was, he was an American war correspondent that had been forced to jump out of an aeroplane. His plane had been hit. And he jumped out and he said, well, what shall I do, you know? And we said, well, we don't know what you're going to do, but we've got a battle on our hands. And we fished around the lads and one of them came up with a P-38 Walther German automatic pistol, and we gave it to him to defend himself with. And we said, well, we're off now. Your best bet is to stay in this timber yard until matters settle down. I'd like to know who the guy was. I've got a good idea, but I'm not sure. I can't be definite.
Who do you think it was?
Well, this chap mentioned to me something about a typewriter, and I can't think of the name. I can't think of the name, but there's a book called The Correspondence or War Correspondence, and I saw a name about a guy who'd lost a typewriter, and I think that's the one. But anyway, off we went in the direction of the bridges on the River Issel. We had to capture the road bridge and the rail bridge, which we succeeded in doing. We took a fair number of casualties in doing it. The platoon finally established itself in a house close to the position where the rail bridge crossed the River Issel, which in effect was only a tiny fordable stream, but it was a deep anti-tank ditch type thing. We took up a position of defence in the house, facing across to the town of Ringenberg. Having settled in, we took stock of our casualties, and we found that almost a third of the platoon had gone, dead, wounded, or missing. We didn't know at the time. We were attacked on a number of occasions from the direction of Ringenberg. And on every occasion, we were able to call in rocket firing Typhoon aircraft. In each case, they came over and broke up the attack almost immediately. These attacks continued throughout the day on the 24th and almost into darkness. At darkness, I went forward on a standing patrol with another chap, Private Balaam, and we located a number of Germans on the far side of the Autobahn, obviously preparing for a further attack, maybe at dawn or even at darkness. And we had to call down for shell fire to break up this group of men. The following day, there were a series of attacks, but they were weakening most of the time. And finally, towards the evening, the troops that had crossed the Rhine by boat arrived to put a protective screen in front of us. And that ends that particular phase. But we were able to take stock then and discovered that on the 24th, the regiment, I believe we landed with some 720 to 740 men, that on the landing and on the fighting on the 24th, we had suffered in excess of 400 casualties, of which 104 were killed. Full stop. I think it was on the 26th, after a short spell in Hammenkeln, where we had some rest and some food and spent one night, we then began the advance across Germany. We went in the next few days, we passed through a series of towns and villages, dead Germans and remnants of German armour were everywhere. We met a number of pockets of opposition, fought many small battles across on the road towards, we were heading in the direction of Bocholt, in the general direction of anything, towards Hanover Way. We had several night marches. We fought a number of running small battles, no big battles, and we lost a number of men, but we were taking vast amounts of Germans prisoner, and everywhere there were signs that the war was coming to a rapid end.
Is that because the Germans wanted to give up?
Well, they were surrendering in droves, yes. There were large numbers of them. The fight had gone out of them. A lot of them were foreign nationals in the German army, and they were glad that it was over. The Germans' civilian population themselves, there were wet sheets hanging out of most windows through the villages and towns we went through.
How did the British troops behave towards the German civilians?
They behaved extremely well. There were one or two odd cases, you know, where some of the lads were pretty aggressive. They'd lost good friends. But I saw no signs of any atrocities committed by British troops at all. And this is a truthful statement. You know, we were glad that we were getting on and that it was all going to be over. And our mood, you know, we began to brighten up. We realised that it was just a matter of weeks, days maybe, because everything, we were advancing so fast. Sometimes we were marching, sometimes we got lifts on the few tanks that were accompanying us, but mainly we walked, and we covered quite a few hundred mile of ground. And it was on the afternoon of the 4th of April we finally arrived at a small farm not too far from the banks of the Weser, where we were told to snatch a few hours' rest. And it was in this small farm that I had the most strange feeling of personal disaster. It's a feeling I'd never had before, and I've heard of people having it. I had the strange premonition that I was going to be killed that night. And I sat down in the farmhouse, and I wrote a letter home to my mother to say that everything was okay, not to worry. Later that night, we went to the banks of the River Weser, which was in flood at the time. There was a heck of amount of water flowing down it and a rapid current. And we done a crossing in these canvas assault boats that the Royal Engineers have. We had some German prisoners of war doing the actual paddling, and we landed on the far bank of the Weser. I can't recall the name of the village where we landed, but the houses were blazing there. One of our forward companies had gone in, and then we had, as a company and a platoon, to go forward to a village called Friller. That's Frirlle, where we were engaged in some house-to-house fighting. The Germans were defending it fairly well. We managed to capture the village, and we advanced through the village. Probably about 9:10, may have been 9 or 10 at night. And having got through the village, we were advancing down the road, and suddenly a burst of machine gun fire rang out, and before I knew what had happened, I got two bullets in my hand and two in my left leg, two in my right hand, two in my left leg. It knocked me to the ground, and I received a nasty electric shock from some cables that were on the ground. Managed to get up and beat most of the other chaps back. They were all running away from the machine gun. And I think I, in spite of two bullets in my leg, I think I was the first one back in the village. There I had a close look at myself, and the whole of the centre of my right hand was shot away. Got a field dressing on it and sprinkled it with a bit of sulphur powder. And one of the lads took me into a house, and I sat down, and he said, "Do you have a smoke, Nobby?" And I said, "Well, I don't smoke." And he said, "Well, have a smoke." He said, "It'll do you the world of good." He said, "It'll make you feel better." So I sat and smoked and smoked and smoked, and I felt as sick as a dog, so I finished smoking. By which time I was getting a lot of pain, and one of them said, "There's all blood on your trousers, Nobby. What's happened?" And they pulled up my trousers, and I got a bullet hole right through my left leg. Anyway, eventually I got down into a cellar because there was a bit of shelling going on. And I lay in the cellar all night. I was in considerable pain. There was no morphine available. And the following morning, probably it would be some 2 or 3 hours after daybreak, a jeep came up to the house. They'd managed to get a jeep across on a raft. And I was put on the jeep, and I was handed a Sten gun and told, would I guard those six prisoners in front while the driver was driving? And we went down to the edge of the river, the banks of the Weser. I was holding a Sten gun, and there were six German prisoners with their hands in the air in front of me, but I don't think I had the strength to pull the trigger anyway, so it was a wasted exercise. But having got down to the river, the MO had just come across, and he looked at me, he said, "What, you again?" And it was Captain Smith. And I said, "Yeah," I said, "I think it's me last time, though." And he got me on a stretcher then. He gave me a dose of morphia, got me on a stretcher, and he instructed a couple of his men to carry me down to a raft. And I can recall that an old German woman came out of the house and snatched the pillow that was under my head and ran back into the house with it, and Captain Smith chased into the house and got the pillow back. This sticks out in my mind. It's one of these incidents that lodge in your mind. And then I was put aboard the raft, and on it there was I think it was either the brigadier or the divisional commander. I was a bit hazy by then, and a newspaper correspondent. And I was covered with a German greatcoat, as a blanket. And I can recall one saying to the other, "Who's that?" And someone said, "It's a German prisoner." And I distinctly recall saying, "I'm not a bloody German and I'm not a prisoner." And then we commenced to cross the river. We were pulled over by ropes from the far bank that was on a sort of a seesaw device. And I was loaded onto a stretcher on a jeep, by which time I was feeling really bad. And I was driven for some hours to another advanced dressing station, where I was offloaded onto the jeep. And I was there for some time. A doctor looked at me eventually, and I received no treatment. And I was reloaded onto the jeep again, and we were driven again for some long distance. And by about, it was now about 6 o'clock in the evening of the 5th of April, and I felt like death, and I thought my premonition was right. And I got eventually to some kind of surgical unit. God knows what it was to this day, I don't know. And I was taken into an old farmhouse, and the stretcher was put on the floor, and I was lifted onto a what looked like a large table. It was a looked like a kitchen table covered with blankets and some kind of mattress. And two doctors, two RAMC doctors, came in, and one of them picked up my hand, sniffed it, and he whispered to his colleague, "Gas gangrene." And although he whispered it, my hearing was so acute that it was as though he'd shouted it. Whether it was the effects of the morphine had heightened my hearing, I don't know, but it was as though he'd shouted it out loud. And then he said, "Well, we'll start straight away." He said, "We'll get some drips and that in." He said, "And if he's still here at 8 o'clock, we'll operate." And so I assumed from that that with loss of blood, I'd been bleeding all night, and the gas gangrene, that I was in a desperate way. This was further confirmed a few minutes later when the padre came in and said, "Not to worry, son, all your personal gear will make sure it will be sent home to your parents." And I thought, well, this is it, I must be close to death. And I thought, well, I'm not going to die. And I didn't. I woke up the following morning at 5 a.m. I was in a large room surrounded by casualties on stretchers, and I immediately demanded of the first orderly I see that I get a strong cup of tea and so something to eat. I felt as fit as a fiddle then. The medicine had done its trick. They'd amputated my hand, they'd dressed my leg, and they'd found a further bullet hole through my foot. So I'd been losing blood from three sources, so I must have been fairly weak, but they'd obviously given me transfusions, got rid of the gas gangrene in the hand by amputating the hand, and I felt 1,000% better.
When did they get you back to Britain?
Well, I stayed. They moved me further back, near to the town of Cleve, which was just a ruin. Everything was bombed. It was just bombed houses here, not a bit like it is today. And I stayed in a tented hospital there for a further 3 days. We were in the care then of the army nursing sisters, and I can recall them, picking me up bodily and carrying me at the toilet. These lasses, they were only slips of girls, but they're terrific strength. And then, much to my horror, we were driven to an airfield outside Cleve, and they said, "We're flying you back to England." And after my previous flight on the Rhine crossing, the last thing I wanted to do was to fly. I was filled with dread at the thought of flying. Anyway, they put us on in a, it was a Dakota, And we flew back to England to Cirencester in Gloucester. I think it was Cirencester, near Cirencester anyway, an airfield near Cirencester, where I was told that they asked me where I lived, and I told them, Dagenham, and they said that you will see that you're sent to a hospital near to your home. And I thought, well, that's good anyway. And I was put on a train, and we had a long journey. And the journey went on right through the night, and eventually we were taken off the train and loaded into ambulances and wheeled into the outpatients department of a hospital, where I lay on the floor with several other chaps among all the civilian outpatient people. And I spoke to one of them. I said, "What part of London are we in?" And she said, "You're not." She said, "You're in Salford, in Manchester, near Manchester." I thought myself, "Well, that's not near home at all, is it?" And I was there for right through the end of April, right through May, and well into June. I was in hospital for close on 3 months. Finally moved down to Roehampton, where I stayed for 2 weeks, and then on discharged to home. But in the on the way, I collected my wife. She was the night nurse at Salford Hospital, and there she is, sitting in the chair. From ho from Roehampton, they released me to my home, and for the next almost a year, apart from one or two visits to various military establishments for various duties, I spent most of my time at home in Dagenham. And it was on the 31st of May 1946 that my discharge finally came through. Full stop. To go back to Salford Hospital, or my period in Salford Hospital, I was fast asleep one day in the ward, and I was suddenly awoken by a voice saying, "Nobby, Nobby." And I awoke and I saw Charlie Godbold. His nickname was Claude, by the way. I sometimes refer to him as Charlie, sometimes as Claude. And there he was. He'd returned from the dead. At first, I thought perhaps I'd died and I'd joined him in heaven. But when I fully woke up, I realized he was there in the flesh. So we had a grand reunion. And although I was bedridden, we managed to scrounge a wheelchair and cross the road into the local pub opposite the hospital, called the Angel, wasn't it? Where we, much against the doctor's orders, I imbibed in a few pints.
Just going back to Normandy, can you tell me what the attitude of the Normandy civilians was towards being liberated?
To be honest, I had very little contact with any of the civilian population at all. We had a brief chat in English and what little French we knew with the Madame Gondre and her husband Georges Gondre on D-Day itself. But other civilians, I think they were happy to see us, but they appeared to be a bit apprehensive because they'd been caught up in a terrific battle. But from their attitude since the war, I would think that the older ones were glad to see us. And whenever we go over there now, they lay on every village after the memorial service. They lay on wine and food. They seem delighted to see us. And they usually lay on the local band, you know. Full stop.